Not imposing on your time any more than we need to. My name is Ed Howard with the Alliance for Health Reform. I want to welcome you to this program that's designed to actually erect, I guess, a few traffic signs to help guide us along the road to implementing the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. We'll call it the ACA for purposes of this program today. Over the next several months, and over the next few years as well. Everybody knows that the healthcare system in the United States is one of the most complicated animals ever devised by legislative counsel. But the complexity doesn't end when the president affixes his signature to the reform legislation. The law says parents must be allowed to cover children under their family policies up to the age of 26. But who qualifies as a child or a resident in a certain place? The law says insurance companies are supposed to spend 85 cents out of their premium dollar on health care as opposed to administrative costs. But when a nurse calls you and asks you if you've taken your medication, is that care or is that administration? All of those questions, scores more, hundreds more, need to be answered. And those answers are going to be found in the process of promulgating regulations and other governmental guidance by the Secretary of HHS and other governmental officials. And today's program is designed to help all of us. Believe me, I have a lot to learn here, too. And it's going to help us learn more about how these regulations and other forms of guidance are put into place. It's not going to explain a lot of health policy to you, unlike, I hope, a lot of our other programs. But you're going to be able to follow the process of how that policy is formulated a lot more precisely than you would have if you hadn't been in on this conversation. And you can ask questions about specific substantive provisions to our expert panel once we get to the Q&A program, part of the program. Let me just say our partner in today's program is the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the nation's largest philanthropy concentrating on health and health care. We're very happy to have Brian Quinn from the foundation with us today. He's a senior program officer in the unit of handling research and evaluation. I want to thank Brian and Lavisa More and her colleagues at the Foundation for supporting this briefing and helping us think through how best to put it together. We should also note that also with Robert Wood Johnson co-sponsorship and support, we're going to be doing sort of the next step in this series of implementation briefings on August 2nd, when we're going to take a much closer look at the interaction between state and federal governments, since that is such a large part of the ACA's machinery. So hold that date, and let's get on with today's program. I want to just make a couple of logistical observations. I want to thank you for your economy of use of space so we can accommodate as many people as we can, and folks are still coming in. I would point out that there are some seats around the perimeter that don't offer you a place to put your stuff and write, but they do give you a place to sit, and it looks like we're going to be right at whatever the fire marshal allows us to be at in terms of the capacity of the room. So thank you in advance, and we apologize for the inconvenience. In your packets today, you're going to find a lot of information that we hope you'll find useful, including speaker biographies, more generous than I'm going to be able to give them. You'll also find their PowerPoint presentations, lots more background available, things we couldn't print and put in those kits at our website, allhealth.org. There is a list of all of the materials that are on that website in your kits printed. and there will be a webcast of this briefing available on Monday at kff.org, compliments of the Kaiser Family Foundation. There'll be a transcript available a few days after that on our website. And I also want to call attention to the fact that you can use the green cards in your packets at the appropriate time to ask a question. There are microphones, two in the front, one in the back. You may find it hard to escape your crowded corridor between tables, in which case just put it on a green card, hold it up, and one of our thin interns will squeeze through the aisle and pick it up. If you're watching on C-SPAN this afternoon and you have access to a computer, you can go to our website at allhealth.org and you can find the PowerPoint presentations and all of the other materials that the folks here in the room have access to. So let's get to the program. We've assembled an incredibly knowledgeable group of panelists today, one of whom is still stuck in traffic, but she's on her way. But we're going to hear brief presentations and then saving the bulk of the time for your questions in this topic. And we're going to start, quite appropriately, with Catherine Hayes. Catherine is lecturer and lead scientist at the Department of Health Policy in George Washington University's School of Public Health and Health Services. And along with Sarah Rosenbaum from that school, she oversees something called Health Reform GPS, which if you haven't visited on the web, you really should. There's an incredible array of information to, as the name would apply, help you find your way through this maze of health reform legislation and law. You may know Catherine, some of you may know Catherine from her days on the Hill. She worked for both John Chafee and Evan Bayh. She also spends some time now as Vice President for Health Policy at Jennings Policy Strategies. Welcome, Gail. Good timing, because you will miss not a single word of Catherine Hayes' presentation. Catherine, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Ed, for the invitation to be here today, and thank you to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for making this possible. I see a lot of new faces in the crowd and a few old faces, and I just want to say that over the years, the Alliance has been such a tremendous source of information for me. I remember when I first started in the Senate with John Chafee coming to your briefings and just learning so much, and the quality of the folks that you've had over the years has been just amazing, and it has really been a tremendous resource, and I really thank you for that.
Well, thank you, and I just want to let people know we haven't relaxed our standards.
So what I'd like to do today is very briefly talk to you a little bit about the Administrative Procedure Act. And when I learned today that was going to be my role on today's panel, it was with a little bit of trepidation, I have to say, to cover a federal law like this that governs how regulations are made and how the administration puts forth interpretations of federal statutes within 8 to 10 minutes is going to be somewhat of a challenge. But that having been said, and also one thing, I was talking to one of my colleagues about this presentation, and he looked over at me and he said, well, I would suggest the following to you. I would remind them that when they were young, their parents told them that they had to have their spinach before they could eat their dessert. And I'm sad to say I'm the spinach today. So I will try to make this as brief as possible, but get through it and impart as much information as I can. So first of all, telling you a little bit about, let's see if I can, do I have it pointed in the wrong direction? Okay. Just as generally, the Affordable Care Act, the goal here, what I would like to do is give you an overview not only of the Administrative Procedure Act and the tools that the agency has before it in order to interpret the Affordable Care Act, but also to give you a sense of the tremendous amount of discretion that the agency has. Congress was vague in many areas of this bill, sometimes intentionally because they could not reach agreement, or sometimes intentionally because they didn't believe that they had the expertise to get down into the nitty-gritty. I remember back in Obra 90, I was working for John Chafee, and we were doing the conference, and Gail was there in the room. And Senator Chafee was talking to Pete Stark about, you know, and he just turned and looked at Chairman Stark and said, you know, don't you think it's insane that a U.S. senator and the chairman of the Ways and Means Health Subcommittee are sitting here negotiating what certified registered nurse anesthetists should be paid under the Medicare program? It's really just absurd. And so that is an example of the minutia that Congress does get into at times, but also to point out that they do give a tremendous amount of discretion to the agencies, and understandably so. So, for example, I saw a spreadsheet the other day that showed that there were more than 540 provisions of federal law that will go into effect between now and September 1st of 2019. And according to a CRS report you have in your packet, only 40 of those directly require the secretary to issue regulations. And we'll go into a little bit about what the other tools are that are available, but it's just one thing I wanted to point out very quickly. Agency rulemaking is governed under the Administrative Procedure Act, which was enacted in 1946 as a response to an increase in the number of government agencies during the FDR administration. Congress, I understand, having looked at the history, worked for 2 years to try to put together rules that govern not only agency hearings, which we're not going to talk about today, but also the rulemaking process generally and getting through that process. So first of all, and there are a number of tools available. First of all, I'd like to just mention formal rulemaking. You will almost never see this. It is something that is pretty much extinct today. In the time that I worked on the Hill, I only heard it mentioned one time. And that was when I was negotiating a provision across the table with an adversary as a 20-something staffer. And I think this opponent realized that he was going to lose on this particular provision, and so we were trying to work out the language. And he turned to me and he said, well, what do you think about requiring formal rulemaking for this particular piece? And I didn't have a clue at the time, but I assumed that since he was suggesting it to me, it must be a bad thing. So I turned to legislative counsel and I asked, what are the requirements associated with formal rulemaking? And he looked at me, and he looked at the gentleman across the table, and he said, trust me, you don't want to go there. So I got very good advice from legislative counsel. Witnesses, you have to have testimony. Everything is on the record. I understand that the code word in the legislation for formal rulemaking, if you ever see it, is that it has to be an on-the-record hearing, and that everything that comes through the regulation has to be a result of these on-the-record hearings, and it's part of cross-examination and just a long list of things. Again, I don't think you really need to know any of this other than to know you don't want it if someone suggests it, or you can use it as a tool for one of your less wary adversaries down the road. Informal rulemaking is primarily what we see today. It requires two things, notice and comment. And it's governed under Section 553 of the Administrative Procedures Act, basically just says that for notice you need time, place, nature, and I've laid them all out there. I won't bother reading through them, but it gives you a good sense of what the agency needs to do to provide adequate notice. There are some exceptions. Some rules are generally exempt from notice and comment, foreign affairs, military, but I understand many of those agencies do use notice and comment. But at the same time, there are exceptions to the notice rule that are those that are determined to be interpretive rules, good cause, and we'll talk about an example of good cause in just a few minutes. This requires the agency to let individuals provide written comment. There is no requirement for them to allow oral comment. Sometimes an agency will have a hearing, but it's not very frequent these days. The comments must allow individuals just a fair opportunity to express their views on the rule that's going to be promulgated by the agency. I wanted to mention negotiated rulemaking, too, which when I took administrative law class in college, I was told yet again this was another way to drive a stake through the heart of a provision, that you never wanted negotiated rulemaking. And I was interested to see in the Affordable Care Act, that there is a provision, Section 5602, which does require negotiated rulemaking. And as I look through the rules of that, just as a refresher, it appears to require a consensus on the part of committee for any changes. So I think that is going to be a long and drawn-out process if that ever happens. And I believe that is the methodology for medically underserved areas, for developing medically underserved or redefining medically underserved areas. Other agency tools that are available, executive orders, and we saw this take place with the abortion language that was a part of health reform. Letters, we've seen Secretary Sebelius issue letters to the governors regarding the high-risk pools and asking them whether or not they would like to participate in them. Letters to state Medicaid directors, we've seen one of those issued already, or often or sometimes called letters to state health officers. One went out shortly after enactment, notifying states that they had the ability to expand Medicaid coverage up to 133% of poverty immediately, or beginning in March, I think. I can't remember the exact date. But that has been employed. You'll see manuals used. There's a Medicaid provider manual. There are Medicare provider manuals. You'll see other kinds of policy statements and other guidance used as well. And those are not considered regulations, but are other tools that are available to the agencies. We also have congressional oversight of, you know, given the amount of discretion that's given to the agency, it's not surprising, or the agencies, and the three primary agencies, as you know, that will be regulating this are the Department of Health and Human Services, Department of Labor, and the Department of Treasury. I expect that over the years we will see quite a number of hearings, as we have in the past on major legislation. Particularly, you begin to see oversight when you see some bad press on something. And so I wouldn't be surprised over the years as things move forward to see that. Typically, we have used letters to the president, letters to agency heads in order to express concerns or to letters of support for actions of various agencies. Congress has often used investigations. Many committees have investigative staff that conduct oversight of federal agencies. And there's also the GAO, and quite frequently you will see letters going to GAO asking them to investigate certain things, or often in legislation you'll see a direct requirement to investigate. And finally, you will see it in legislation as well, either authorizing legislation in which there will be a direct change in the law. Say they're not happy with the way a Medicare provision is being implemented, you might see an amendment to the Medicare statute to change or refocus the agency's direction, for want of a better term. And at the same time, you may sometimes see sort of last-ditch efforts to block agency action through the appropriations process. How many of you have ever seen language in an appropriations bill that says, no funds under this act shall be used for the purpose of? And quite often that is done as well. So, and then finally, with my last 20 seconds, I would like to mention that there is also judicial review of agency action. And I'm very glad that I only have 10 seconds left for this one, because it is quite controversial. And the one thing you need to know is Chevron v. NRDC. It's very hard, in summary, to overturn agency action, but there is a test, and it's laid out there for you. Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine. There'll be a quiz on that case at the end of the 2 hours, so Google it while you're listening. By the way, one of the things in your packets that we did, I was going to say we did reprint, but we in fact did not reprint, we received pretty copies, is the regulatory chart, the map, if you will, of the regulatory process that Catherine has just explained so well. And I want to thank our friends at ICF Incorporated for providing those copies. I can't imagine a more comprehensive and accurate guide to that entire range of administrative possibilities than you see in that one chart that you can put up on your wall and study. following your absolutely fabulous background, we're going to get some real-life experience. Please welcome back Gail Walensky, health economist extraordinary, senior fellow at Project Hope, former occupant of the director's desk at what is now CMS, advisor to President George H.W. Bush on health and social policy, chair of MedPAC. We don't have time. Look at the bio that's in your materials. In short, Gail understands not just Medicare and Medicaid, but the healthcare system as well as anybody around. Key components of the major changes called for in this new law are very much tied to both Medicare and Medicaid, as you have already heard alluded to. So we are looking to a little bit of past experience and comments on the current situation from Gail Walensky. Gail, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ed. It's a pleasure to be here. This is indeed a very interesting time as we move from focusing on the legislative process to figuring out how we're going to implement this piece of legislation. I think it is fair to say this is a hugely complex bill. The changes that are involved in terms of implementation will affect all levels of government. They will, of course, importantly affect the private sector, all parts of healthcare, in terms of those involved with providing services to Medicare or Medicaid, and those who help support the people who provide services to Medicare and Medicaid as well. State governments will be very busy. HHS in general has already been very busy. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, of course, will be busy. And I want to share from my experience having been in this seat and also having continued to have involvement with people in various administrations and through MedPAC, something about what they're likely to be going through now. The first point that I wanted to share with you is to put in some perspective some of the challenges that the agency is likely to face. Catherine and some of your bosses aside, in general, CMS is the agency that Congress loves to hate. It was easier when it was HCFA to say one of the many four-letter words around Washington that got a lot of disdain and negative comments. A little harder now that they're a three-letter word. It is a challenged organization, but not because of any concern about the people who work there, either as political appointees or on a career basis. They are a very excellent group of people. But because the agency has historically been starved for funds, several of us who have sat in that seat and others who have been involved have signed various letters indicating the problems that come about because the agency is not adequately funded. I want to be clear, this is not meant to disparage this particular Congress or this administration. As I've indicated, there is equal opportunity of use that has been provided by Republican and Democratic Congresses and by the executive branch as well as the Congress. And part of it has to do with how the administrative support functions are financed, and that is, unlike the benefits which come as an entitlement through the Finance and Ways and Means Committee, the support of the program itself is a direct appropriation and has to compete with very coveted and cherished dollars and usually loses. It's a problem because it has meant long-term too little support. There have been retirements. You could see that in the 90s that this was going to happen just in terms of the age span of senior people there. And while there is some additional funding for implementation, as there was for the Medicare Modernization Act, it is only on a temporary basis. In addition to that, there are some other challenges that the organization is going to face. In the first place, they have had a realignment or reorganization. Many times this happens. I can only tell you that reorganizations cause some amount of havoc, sometimes a large amount and sometimes a small amount, but always some amount of havoc and turmoil when they occur as people try to figure out where they are, whether they had the same amount or comparable authority, and what life will be like going forward. This is a particularly inopportune time to be facing that. We have not had a confirmed administrator, which you see that I've bolded and italicized. Since 2006, Unfortunately, Kerry Weems was never confirmed. He was an acting administrator from the time he was there in late 2006. And we still do not have a confirmed administrator per se. As you all know, to the surprise of most of us, Don Berwick was appointed through a recess appointment 2 days ago. I think that was terribly unfortunate at this particular time. It was quite early in the process. He had only been named in April. There had not even been a hearing yet scheduled. It will have at least two very serious ramifications for him, and I say this as somebody who is a longtime close colleague and friend to Don. First is his tenure is limited by definition to the end of December of 2011. And second of all, to my mind, his appointment is tainted, at least for the Republicans. Even those who had not spoken out in any way about issues he had raised in the past, just because of the process that would be used, he and the administration and the agency do not need this. It will complicate life for everybody. So you will. I don't normally feel quite so strongly. I am very frustrated and saddened for Don and the extra burden he will carry. It will be interesting to observe his first congressional hearing to see how that plays out. So having said that, now what? Well, CMS and other parts of HHS are very busy. They are forming work groups. They are drafting timelines for the reg production. They are establishing how regs will be reviewed once they're being put together. Importantly, they'll have to figure out how to resolve disputes that go on internally within the agency so that you don't get into a forever do loop, which is easy to have happen. And they will be meeting very frequently. The part that makes all of this so tricky is that the regular functions of the department and the agency have to go on, a small matter like running Medicare and overseeing Medicaid. Now, I just want to share a little bit about the kind of process, and I'm going to use one that was, for me, a major activity, not the only activity by any means, but a major activity, and that was getting the rules out to implement the relative value scale. It was passed, somewhat to everyone's surprise, very late by the Congress, just before they recessed.
Gail, let me just make sure there are enough people as...
I will define what...
Yes, that's a good idea.
This is the resource-based relative value scale. It was the switch from using historical payments by Blue Cross Blue Shield to a different way to reimburse physicians. Interestingly, it had not yet been completed. It was being worked on by Bill Shao and the American Medical Association. It had not yet been completed when the Congress passed it into law with a start date of January 1st, 1992. So first we had to make sure that there were ongoing strategies that the actual relative value scale would be completed. It was a lot of work with various physician groups. And then we internally had to make sure that we would be ready to operationally implement a rule after we knew what that rule would actually look like, and that required putting out a proposed rule. And we had a challenge, which sometimes happens. The rule was written in such a micro-prescriptive manner that it was internally inconsistent. And we weren't quite sure how to deal with that, so with advice of general counsel, we did our best guess at what made sense, knowing that it was actually inconsistent with parts of the law, and threw it out for comments. We received 100,000 comments in return. It was the most at any time. You don't have to respond to each person who puts in a comment, but you must respond to each issue that is raised in a comment, which meant that the careerist had to go back and very busily respond to all of the issues that had been raised in these 100,000 comments. But indeed, with an enormous amount of effort, led, by the way, bureaucratically by Joe Antos, he was the head of the work group, it, in fact, got out and payments started, indeed, January of 1992. But what is going on now is so much more complicated. It is more complicated than, to me, the other most complicated piece of legislation in my professional lifetime, and that was the Balanced Budget Act. that was a time where you had to put all changes in terms of the annual updates. We have to do that now with this new legislation. There are a huge number of one-time startup changes, a new innovation center, which is critical to everything that is going to happen with regard to cost containment, has to get set up, adopt rules, figuring out how it is going to be able to have pilots and demonstrations act in a way that the agency has never been able to act flexibly, quickly, and spread to, if not a national basis, at least a larger basis to see how they would work when upscaled. And, of course, oversight has to be provided for all of the Medicaid changes of which they are meting. Medicare does not, or CMS does not, run Medicaid in the way it runs Medicare, but it is responsible for providing some of the oversight that is needed. There are many challenges, a lot of challenges, but I just wanted to mention one that struck me as likely to be particularly thorny, and that is the writing the rules that will define the hospital value-based purchasing program. Linda may want to chime in on that as well, because the regulations will have to define such things as how the performance measures are established, the methodology that is going to be used to calculate the hospital performance itself, the methodology that will be used to determine the amount of incentive-based payments, and many other areas, all of which are likely to be very controversial. We got 100,000 responses at HCFA with the proposed rule for the relative value scale. I suspect it will be at least that many when this rule is released. And, of course, the payment has to be ready to go by 2012. And this is just one of many controversial payments. So in what is meant in the most sincerest way, I wanted to end with good luck, CMS. For many reasons, you will need it. There are many of us who will be eager to help if we can, but basically the baton is now passed to you. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Gail. By the way, a couple of things we weren't able to put into the packets in time because when we got them, one of them is a little one-page front-and-back article by Gail in which she lays out in a column and a half about 15 major efforts that CMS is basically having to undergo at the same time right now, not to mention what happens after they're done. And I commend it to you, and there are a couple of other pieces you should pick up on your way out as well. And that brings us to our final panelist, Linda Fishman. Linda is the Vice President of Public Policy Analysis and Development at the American Hospital Association. Rumor is that the hospitals are affected by some of the provisions in the ACA, and Linda heads up AHA's efforts to make sure hospitals' vital interests are presented in these regulatory processes as they go forward. And as we have alluded to, Linda has also occupied very high positions both in the administration, within HHS, and has been on both sides of the Hill advising House and Senate folks on how to deal with these things from this point of view. So we're very pleased to have a threefer in Linda Fishman. Linda?
Thank you very much, Ed, and thanks to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for supporting this event, and I'm very glad to be here. I'm representing the stakeholder group today, and just a little word about the American Hospital Association. We represent over 5,000 hospitals across the country of all different stripes, from short-term acute care hospitals to long-term acute care hospitals, the whole spectrum of hospital services. And while my remarks are often specific to the hospital community, I also have some remarks that I think can be applied to the general stakeholder audience. For example, one of the things I kind of get a charge out of this is people come up to me and say, Linda, you must be really relieved that health reform is now the law. And I have a very different view of the world. For me, implementation is just the beginning of a lot of activity. And we have lots of work to do at the AHA, and I particularly like this quote because The rules have started to come in 2010, but there will be rules coming for the next 6, 7, 8 years. And I may be retired by then, but as I look across the audience to many of these young faces, you will certainly be engaged in all these activities. And I would add to what Gail had said, and I was at CMS for the implementation of the Medicare Modernization Act, which brought a drug benefit to Medicare beneficiaries. And I would say one of the most important things that CMS could be doing is undertaking a massive education effort on the part of the agency, and they have multiple audiences to whom to talk. It includes the beneficiaries. It includes the provider groups. It includes the taxpayers. It includes you folks on Capitol Hill and in the stakeholder community, and that's a very big undertaking to organize. The other issue is that the sheer length and volume of the bill, 2,000 pages, it runs to, and lots of details, as Catherine said, need to be filled in. Both HHS, Labor, and Treasury will be implementing this bill, but I mostly focus on what's happening in the Department of Health and Human Services and expressly in CMS. And I raised this slide because CQ Weekly reported in an article not too long ago that the secretary shall is a phrase that is mentioned 1,045 times in the legislation. That's the secretary shall. The word shall is mentioned about 4,400 times in terms of the mandates that exist in the new law. And also, there are the phrases the secretary may, the secretary has the authority to, the secretary determines. The secretary is going to be very, very busy. Now, it's interesting that I should be asked to speak at this session today because in about 2 weeks, the AHA Board of Trustees is meeting. And one of the things they've asked the team at the Washington office is to produce a strategic plan for regulatory advocacy. And this particular slide is a very brief summary of the kinds of things we're going to be doing. Of course, your members want to know that you have a plan for implementation, and that's very important. And I think that's true of all stakeholder groups across the spectrum. They want to know what you're going to be working on. And in fact, while it is a lot of work for us, we look at this as an opportunity to further influence how healthcare reform is implemented, for better or for worse. So we have devised a plan, and these are the general outlines of how we go about it. We've developed a number of member resources and tools so far. For example, once President Obama signed the law, we came out with a brief summary. Several weeks later, we produced a legislative advisory. I brought it with me. It's 90 pages long. It took us a couple weeks. And by the way, I have a team of about 12 policy people who work with me on these issues. We produced a financial calculator to send to our members so that they could assess the financial impacts of the payment reductions and also perhaps the coverage that was going to be attained by having people newly insured in the system so they could be the impact, they could assess the impact. We produced a timeline, and I'm going to get to that in a minute. We also produced a document that addressed how hospitals should view the new law as employers. Hospitals are often the largest employers in their communities, and so they wanted to know how the insurance changes and the coverage changes will affect how they self-insure their own employees as well. And we produced a series of PowerPoint presentations, because we're very big on that at the AHA, that CEOs of hospitals could deliver not only to the internal hospital audience explaining the new law, but also slides that they could use in their communities to explain the new law to consumer groups and so on. So there's a whole process there where you're educating, you're developing tools to help people understand the law, you're creating timelines. We've created issues and the general strategic plan in terms of trying to find out if you need to talk to advisory groups of members, because, you know, we're kind of pointy-headed Washington policy types. We're not always knowledgeable about what goes on in the real world, excuse me, beyond the Beltway. And one example of that that's not particularly related to the Affordable Care Act is the issue of health information technology, where the staff had to put together a group, an informal network of our members, of chief information officers, so that we could learn more about how health information technology is adopted. We've also solicited input from our state hospital associations. We have them in every state throughout the country. And that's been particularly important with respect to the insurance aspects of the new law. And, of course, we want to lead hospitals in the rulemaking process that Catherine described. We expect to have early influence on how those rules are developed through meetings and listening sessions with CMS officials and people from HHS. And then finally, there is the process of congressional oversight that Catherine mentioned in terms of how the new law is being implemented, and then assessing whether or not the provider community or stakeholders need additional changes to the legislation. And we certainly we have a fix-it list already written in some cases. One of my friends at CMS said this is the era of the chartists, and they're all over the place making charts and timelines. This particular one is ours, and I don't expect you to be able to read it. But I did want to show you, this just about killed the staff at the AHA. We did it in-house. It took us about 6 weeks, and you'll notice that it's done on a quarterly basis. It runs to 17 pages that look like this, and it's multidimensional in terms of the colors. Like you can see at the top, the kind of light green is consumers and coverage. The next one down is payment and revenue or tax policies that have been changed. The next row, I guess you'd say, is delivery system reform and quality. The next one is wellness and workforce issues. And finally, we have a large category called other, which gets at Medicare and Medicaid program integrity, things like administrative simplification and application of tax policies to tax-exempt hospitals that the IRS will be implementing. And so you can see that simultaneously each quarter of the year for the next this runs out to 2018 in our particular timeline, there is a lot going on and a lot we have to worry about. Delivery system reforms, I'm not going to talk about these too much, but I just want to point out that some of these integrated care models that have found their way into the new law are supported in a bipartisan fashion. No matter what would have happened in health reform, I think the momentum was there to try new ways of paying providers, and those include things like accountable care organizations, the bundling of payments, medical homes to deliver better primary care to beneficiaries. And then, of course, we have the hospital payment changes that are not quite so much of a surprise to us. Gail mentioned value-based purchasing, and it's certainly a big new system that's going to be applied to hospitals. We're also very concerned about how the readmissions policy is applied, because all those things I've listed in the slide have penalties attached to them, that if hospitals don't do them, they get a penalty with respect to reduced payments. And so we've been quite attuned to how those are going to play out. These are another group of issues we're following. I want to say our strategic plan that I just showed you, we have a page on 40 different issues we're following at the association. And, of course, the things I'm showing you, they each have a page and a plan for how we're going to influence our advocacy on the regulatory side of things. Our state-based hospital associations obviously are going to be very concerned about the insurance aspects, the Medicaid program, and how the exchanges are set up. And I think from a CMS perspective, as well as from a provider perspective, how this all is going to fit together is a huge challenge. For example, in the law, there is the requirement of reporting a lot of quality data in various types of delivery mechanisms. And, for example, ACOs, Accountable Care Organizations, there will be quality reporting data within that mechanism. In value-based purchasing, that's really the essence of value-based purchasing. Well, how do readmission rates relate to what's happening in value-based purchasing, and who at CMS is going to be meeting to make sure that there isn't overlap or conflicting regulations and rules so that we can make some coherent sense of this? And finally, I would point out, and Gail made this point quite well, that the CMS folks are not only going to have to implement a lot of these new delivery systems, like medical homes, like bundling, for example, and a lot of different types of bundling, but they also have to maintain the siloed payment systems that exist today in the fee-for-service system, and that is represented by these blue silos across the slide. And then overlaid on top of this is are the concepts of accountable care organizations and post-acute care bundling and just a variety of different kinds of payment mechanisms. And sorting those things out, because they're all interrelated, I think is a very daunting challenge to CMS. So I'm going to stop there and turn it back to Ed. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you very much, Linda. Mm-hmm. Now we get a chance to have you come into the conversation. There are microphones at the front on either side that you can come to ask a question. If you want to fill out a green card and hold it up, we'll get it up here. If you can't get to one of these mics and want to try to ask a question orally, if you'll hold up your hand, we have one handheld mic in the back, and we'll try to get it to you. But we definitely want to try to respond to your questions. Linda, let me just ask to put some meat on the bones that you just laid out. Have you already submitted comments on some proposed regulations from AHA's point of view?
The only thing that we have, we always have our routine comments that we file with respect to the various payment systems. And we've certainly done that, and we will continue to do that. And that is normally done through the notice and comment rulemaking process that Catherine mentioned. And it's very predictable in terms of when the rules come out, because there are dates that by which CMS has to have issued those rules. But with respect to health reform, we did comment at the request of some of our members on how the medical loss ratio should be defined. And that's an insurance issue that is not what I would say one of our bread and butter issues has been. But in the context of the new law, we expect to take a fair degree of interest in those kinds of things. So we did do that on the medical loss ratio and how it should be defined.
And let me just ask any of the panelists, if they happen to know this, is my understanding correct that there is a procedure for people who would like to see what comments have been filed to take a look at them electronically, rather than having to troop down to the Humphrey Building and flip through all the pages? Catherine?
Yes, I remember. I haven't actually looked at the website myself, but I understand that all comments will be posted electronically.
So you can see if we're going to get to 100,000 on any particular aspect of this thing. We have a question here, and would ask you to both identify yourself and to be as brief as you can.
Sure. Bernadette Fernandez with the Congressional Research Service, and this is a question for the entire panel. I'd like the panel to comment on the fact that HHS has this huge challenge in promulgating rules and essentially beginning to regulate the private health insurance market that, as Linda said, I mean, that's just not an area where many folks have been focusing on. And this is particularly a state level type of thing. So I'd like to hear the panel's thoughts on what HHS kind of needs to do in order to really meet the challenge, what kind of capacity they have to develop, et cetera.
Neil?
Well, I think you've already seen the attempt to be responsive in areas where there has not been expertise in the medical loss ratio. It's obviously a challenge for them. They have brought in a number of people who have either been involved in the insurance regulation or in commenting on consumer protection issues with regard to insurance. It will be important, although I don't know how much of this has gone on, to also have people who have actually been involved in providing the service. That has frequently been a challenge for government for lots of reasons, including the payment level, in this case, people who have actually been a senior official in an insurance company. It's important to get practicing physicians when you're doing other kinds of regulations, that you have access to people who have not just critiqued the area or had theoretical views about it, but have actually run it. And I think in general this is a problem that has been true in short supply in CMS and in HHS in general, is that there's not been a lot of operational experience, and that makes all of this much more challenging, likely to have even more pushback than the sort of expected pushback if rates are getting pushed down or people are at risk for having penalties in addition to incentive payments, as Linda indicated. That brings out a lot of response. So I think my 100,000 experience is definitely going to get broken. I just don't know by how much.
Gaffer?
I think we're very fortunate right now to have a Secretary of HHS who is both a former governor and a former insurance commissioner. I think that her expertise here is going to go a long way, not only in dealing with the substance of the insurance market requirements that they're going to have to deal with, but also in her relationship with governors and insurance commissioners, who will play a very strong role in this. And I think clearly there are going to be some states who are going to be very good at this, and they're going to work very closely with the Secretary to try to get these rules put in place and to try to enforce them. There are going to be other states that would like to do it probably, but may not have the expertise and are going to need a lot of technical assistance from this administration. And the agency is really building up staff capacity to do that and trying to bring in people with expertise, as Gail mentioned. But then finally, you know, as we've seen by the lawsuits, there are going to be a lot of states that are not interested in participating with the federal government at all. And in those instances, I think you're going to see the administration try to put together a very strong federal fallback to make sure that either through some sort of national exchange or other mechanism, you see people with access to choices to affordable health insurance coverage.
There's a question just came forward on a card that actually was occurring to me as I was looking through the materials for today's briefing. When can an external group start talking with HHS officials about how a provision may be implemented? Can they do it before there's a proposed or interim rule, or do they have to wait till there's a published proposed rule and write a written comment after it has been published? And I might add, are there limits on the people within HHS to whom you can talk in these various circumstances?
Well, I can say legally that only during the formal rulemaking process are there limits on what they call ex parte communications without having all affected parties in the room. So in the informal rulemaking process, obviously it will vary by administration and their willingness and the ability, frankly, of career staff and the time they have to meet with folks. But I think it's just what I understand that is going on right now is that they're looking at the deadlines that are coming up and trying to address the nearest deadlines first. And I know that they have been reaching out to the community. They're trying to staff up and get folks in and talk to them and get input into this. But I think it's a real challenge right now.
It is a real mistake not to reach out because it's not like these people are going to go away. So you have at least a chance to know what's on their minds and to think about whether they are raising legitimate issues and how to try to balance the needs of the people who are approaching an agency with the needs of the public or making sure that the law is implemented. Unfortunately, rulemaking is a very arcane, obscure art form. And one, it resides in EPA, CMS, and FDA for the most part, and their other agencies have. But those are very heavy-duty rulemaking agencies. And it is very hard to effectively staff up with people who have had expertise in this particular arcane area. And that's just a challenge. I mean, just it's just a fact of life. I agree very much with the comment that the secretary's background should help at the top have somebody who has knowledge about some of the issues that will come up. My concern is really at the agency operating level, how it's going to perform all of these rulemaking responsibilities. And the answer is I just have no idea how that's going to happen. But it is difficult. It's not that there aren't any people out there, just not the kind of experience most people would have had any reason to have.
Linda?
Yeah, in our case, once the comment period closes, you can go into CMS and have a meeting with people, but they can't really say anything about what they're doing. So, you know, the objective, if it is to have a dialogue, and it usually is, you want to go in and talk to CMS officials before the comment period closes, where you can actually have a dialogue. Right now what's going on is I think the agency is being inundated with requests for meetings as people, say, who are interested in doing some of these new delivery system reforms want to go in and tell people at CMS what they're doing in hopes of influencing how they think about writing the rule. And so that's kind of the early influence process, and there really is an exchange of information there. And then you write your comments, and even though you send a comment letter, you still can ask, and we do ask for meetings where we will go in and explain our comment letter to the relevant individuals. We'll also, for example, go visit people in the department, if appropriate. We'll go over to the Office of Management and Budget because, you know, we haven't really talked about that, but OMB signs off on all these rules. And so if you have a particularly difficult issue, you certainly want OMB to be able to understand your position from an advocacy perspective.
Sometimes it's referred to as another bite at the apple.
Exactly.
Yeah, and Catherine, I don't know whether you were going to do this, but in addition to what you were going to do, could you also talk a little more about OMB's role in this? Because I find it fascinating, and I know you've talked about it in other forums, but we haven't really touched on it today.
Boy, actually what I was going to do is say that I'm a big fan of yours as an author from CRS. You know, we have as congressional staff, you know, I hope you recognize how lucky you are to have access to CRS and its professional staff. They're just the most amazing group of nonpartisan folks that, you know, I've ever seen and are able to pull together things just overnight that are tremendous help. And as far as OMB is concerned, you know, I'm not sure that I am in the best position to talk about that right now. I haven't talked to anyone over there for quite a while. But, you know, during the clearly as they move through the budget process and try to put together the next year's budget, as they begin to work that, they will play a role there. And also as the bill itself is implemented, I know that OMB will be looking at each regulation very carefully, and probably Gail can address this, having had to sit down with OMB officials in the past.
Yeah, actually, both of you have had institutional experience along those lines.
A proposed rule or final rule, travels up through HHS. So first CMS will have to negotiate isn't the right word, but get a bill cleared by its various friends and the other assistant secretary levels and go through the office of the secretary. And at that point, it will then go over to OMB, I think both through the relevant PAD and also the office of OIRA will have final say before a rule goes out. This becomes a factor because of timing, and it's this issue about making sure you allow for a timeline that will get a proposed rule or a response to a proposed rule through when there are timelines, and some of the material you've included indicates those regulations that have a deadline attached to them and those that do not, although they may have an implied deadline because of other aspects that they deal with, that you have to allow for these various clearances. Now, it has been known in the annals of mankind that these timelines are not always met, and I'm sure that is going to happen on occasion during this process. But sometimes there are serious consequences if, in fact, a payment has to go into effect. You really need to get the rule moved along. But there are many stages after CMS or if it's another part of HHS. And when you see the secretary shall, that usually means after being delegated to, in this case, frequently the administrator of CMS, but it may be ASPE or one of the, I'm not exactly sure where the various insurance groupings in HHS are housed, who it is that they report to, but that person would also be the, when it says the secretary shall, the delegated arm of that.
Okay. Actually, I wanted to follow up on one other timeline question, but let me just say before I do that, some of you may have to leave over the course of the next half hour or so. If you would please fill out that blue evaluation form before you go. It would help us as we try to come up with topics and speakers and formats that will be most helpful to you. So thanks very much in advance for that. And this actually builds on the emphasis on CRS that we've had here over the last few minutes. I've seen several timelines of implementation, including the Goodwin CRS's that is included in the packet. But are there any public official timelines for rulemaking, i.e., one when rules will be issued, when comment periods will be allowed, and so forth? Anybody seen anything like that?
Not to my knowledge. What we've done is we've taken the dates in our timeline, and then we will back out according to the rules of the APA what the days are, and so you back it out, if you will, to the point where you can expect a rule at a certain time. And if they do it more quickly, that's, you know, desirable. But there should be, you should be able to be have a schedule based on the effective date. Now, a lot of the things in the bill do not have effective dates, a lot. And those are quite challenging as to what to do with them.
Okay. Very good. Let me just point out that I have an awful lot of green cards in front of me. So if you want to be absolutely sure that your question gets asked, you might want to try to fight your way to one of the mics up here or wave your hand furiously, and Lindsay Cook will make her way with the handheld mic in your direction. We've got a couple of related questions here that have to do with authorizations and appropriations. There seem to be a lot of places in the law, this person writes, that describe authorizations as such sums as may be necessary or out of funds not otherwise appropriated. Is there a possibility that these provisions won't get funded since it requires congressional action and available funds are short? And a related question is, four programs that were authorized but not appropriated internally in the Act, will agencies develop program guidelines or wait and see if funding materializes?
I think, first of all, the question is, yes, there are definitely programs that are in the Health Reform Act that will likely not receive appropriations. In fact, I think we've heard that from the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee or the Senate. I can't remember which. But there was a statement put out that it is possible and very likely that a lot of these programs won't be funded. I think one thing that's really interesting that you see in there is for the first time we have a direct spending line for a lot of the Public Health Service Act programs, which we have not seen in the past, particularly for the federally qualified health centers. I think some of the emergency preparedness money and a few other provisions there, which will relieve some of the pressure on the Appropriations Committee to fund these particular programs. but still I think it's going to be a challenge.
The agency is clearly going to have to prioritize its efforts. My presumption is that in areas where there's some question about whether or not there will be an appropriation to follow the authorization, that would not likely get priority placement in terms of rulemaking unless there was some other strong driving force that would have that happen. But this whole period of the next several years, mainly between now and 2014, where you get this very rapid fire phase-in of an enormous amount of change, is going to require movements on many fronts, and to make sure that the most significant and serious get the highest priority and that others are backfilled as they can. So I would be very surprised if there are areas where there is some question about whether there will be an appropriation, that they would have much time devoted until that is cleared up.
And there's one thing that I wanted to point out, too, and probably most of you know this, but I was at one forum once in which there seemed to be some confusion about the whole issue of authorization and appropriation when it came to the coverage provisions. And with respect to the subsidies for low-income individuals to obtain health insurance coverage, that those are not appropriated programs that are not subject to appropriation. It's done through the tax code. In addition, the Medicaid expansions will not be subject to appropriation. That's mandatory spending. So.
There's one word that is undecipherable to my 67-year-old eyes. Could you comment, however, it's a good question, could you comment on the issue of congressional intent when regulations may come close to the line of intent? You get the idea.
This is an issue that I raised in this. This is an issue I raised in the short piece I wrote that's outside. Normally, congressional intent is always a magical term if you're in the administration, but the way you decipher congressional intent is you look at the conference and you look at colloquies that may have come about during the course of the legislative process. One of the many intriguing challenges associated with this particular piece of legislation is that having bypassed that normal process, there is not the normal or customary ways of figuring out what do these guys actually mean anyway when they wrote this language, because you don't have the conference proceedings or the colloquies to turn to. So it will be trying to figure it out or as best you can. On the other hand, it gives a lot more flexibility and leeway to the administration in terms of implementing ambiguous, unclear legislative language. It's a very complicated bill. I haven't tried to go through to see how many times that might be true, but it will make it difficult for a stakeholder group to say that you are going against congressional intent if it isn't part of the statute, because there won't be those normal sources of information that people use. Having said that, at least there has been some history. Again, I don't want to say this is how it's being viewed now, because I'm in no position to know that. But if it's not in the statute and it's only in the conference proceeding or a colloquy, it may have been the intent of some members of Congress, but it never made it into the statute. So it is not always that the agencies or the departments will put too much stock in intent that was not actually specified in the legislative language.
How about, if you will, ex-party communications from members of Congress? Suppose you get a letter in the agency from the chairman and the ranking minority member.
Well, you just made it somewhat easier. I mean, if you get it from a member of Congress, you have the problem of it's a member of Congress. There are a lot of other members of Congress that may or may not feel that way. To the extent that you have it from the appropriate committee, and it includes both the majority and ranking minority, that carries more weight. It would usually be reassuring if you had some sense that the other body of Congress was in the same position. What becomes difficult is in trying to be responsive to what may be very strong feelings of certain members of Congress, you may be going against the wishes of other members of Congress. And there may be an attempt informally to try to sense whether or not this is where most, at least of the senior membership, is or not, because, you know, it doesn't really help you very much if you are going to have other members who become very upset. At senior members who become very upset at what has been released. And the oversight is both formal and informal. Formal in the sense that Congress can pass legislation that blocks the implementation of any rule in addition to the appropriations strategy. That happened several times when HCFA was trying to implement the capital part of prospective payment, for example. They just a line inserted into legislation. So there is congressional oversight and congressional stoppage of regulations that it decides it doesn't like.
And one of the favorite tactics of stakeholder groups, not just the AHA, but all stakeholder groups, is something called the Dear Colleague Letter that you may all be familiar with in terms of getting a robust number of signatures from members of Congress to agree to write a certain kind of letter. And, you know, we use that tactic quite a bit, and the goal is always to get 218 members of the House of Representatives and 51 senators to sign the letter and send it off to the Secretary or CMS. And, you know, that everyone does that, and that's just one of the ways to influence the process. And I guess the question is that if you get it within the comment period, is it treated like a comment, if you will? And I think it is in some instances. I don't know, Gail, if you ever took it seriously, but
well, you're taking it seriously when you get that many letters from or signed from membership of Congress is something you always take seriously. The big question has to do whether there are financial implications. And let me just give you an example. This will be relevant for people who have been around here a lot, but the issue it comes up. When we were doing this resource-based relative value scale rule, there was a lot of controversy about how physicians would react to all of the changes in payment and whether basically they would make some adjustments in volume of services because of reductions in fees that were being paid, and the actuaries had made a particular projection, which was included in the rule, which many members of Congress did not support, probably with a lot of help from constituents and stakeholders, indicating that was not something they wanted to see. There were something like 400 members of Congress that went against this, but it would cost. There was a cost attached with changing that part of the rule. So you can have every single member of Congress against an aspect of rulemaking if there's a cost attached and they are following in a serious way PAYGO rules. It doesn't count unless somebody comes up with the money. So congressional participation is always regarded by an agency seriously, but if it is a suggestion that has a financial cost, unless there's also a money source attached to it, it may be dismissed as not relevant.
Hi, Jim Hahn, CRS, and thanks for the kind words about CRS. If we can get Linda to say something, maybe we'll hit the trifecta. I want to emphasize that, as has been pointed out, CRS is objective and nonpartisan, and use that as a basis for bringing up a question about perhaps the gorilla in the room unmentioned, or maybe more appropriately, the elephant, which is that obviously healthcare reform has been a major pillar of the domestic agenda for the Democrats, and yet we're hearing that come November, repeal and replace might be a mantra that we'll be hearing quite often from the Republicans. And so I think this has been very informative. I wonder if the panel could spend a few minutes educating us on what happens to this entire process you've been talking about when you suddenly throw it into reverse, or it's not even reverse, maybe a sharp right.
All
I think the short answer to that is that President Obama would never sign legislation from the Congress that would repeal and replace for at least as long as President Obama is in office. I think it's more likely, at least as we see it, that there will be attempts to perhaps change certain provisions. But again, getting them through the Congress and the President's signature on them, I think is going to be very difficult in the near term. And Jim Hahn, let the record show, I loved CRS when I was on the Hill. And I called you a lot.
And I just want to emphasize the comment in terms of the timeline that Linda just made. It is difficult to imagine a scenario where it would be politically possible to see this legislation repealed between now and 2012 in the way legislation, the catastrophic legislation, was repealed in 1989. Although, had there been and were there to be a massive change in public sentiment, it is certainly technically possible that you would get a change in heart by enough people in the Congress after the next election that technically that could happen. It's hard to imagine any scenario in this first term where you would have the numbers of votes. After 2012, it obviously depends on who's president. What is much more likely in my mind to happen is that we will see a series of legislative changes to this bill for many reasons. In the first place, there are always a series of legislative changes to complex legislation. There were at least three following the Balanced Budget Act because there are unintended consequences or other issues that come up that you didn't anticipate. So we ought to assume that there will be legislation revising this Affordable Care Act for the next decade. And the question is, are they big and major changes? Are they relatively minor refinements, but keeping the basic program structure as it exists now the same? That will depend very largely on the composition of the Congress, the mood of the country, and then after 2012, the presidency. So there will be changes, and they could be very significant. And the fact that you have 2010, 2012, and 2014, but certainly 2010 and 2012 for sure, before most of the real reform occurs, that's translated as the stuff that costs all the money, there are at least two elections to get through before we will have a program in place. Once the program is in place, it becomes increasingly more difficult to change it other than to expand it. At least that's my view of our past history. But there's a lot of time between now and 2014.
Catherine, you want to add anything to that?
No, I agree.
Let me just try another angle on that to try to add to the very insightful comments I think we've heard. A couple of Republican members of Congress have said to me that if we can't repeal it, we'll starve it to death. And we've talked before about the appropriations process. How much of the substance of the ACA is in play here in the appropriations process? Clearly, the Medicaid changes are not. The insurance changes are not. Unless, of course, you insert a provision in an appropriations bill that say you shall not spend a penny for this purpose. Mm-hmm. Is this at all realistic? Or what is the potential, I guess, is a fairer question.
It has been very difficult historically to do this type of a starving unless you have a very large majority behind you. I mean, these issues were raised with regard to war efforts. Now, that may be a bad analogy because even if you are against the effort, you've got people in harm's way, and they may be the ones that would be most immediately affected. But it has been hard to use this process So you could technically see this as a way to go after all those things that are not mandatory funding. But a lot of the activity in this early period is, I think, not at risk. So I think the real question is going to be what happens in November, what happens in 2012, and whether or not there is a significant change in the mood of the country about where we are with regard to this amount of increased spending and the benefits that are associated or not, and that is going to be much. I would find it, you know, there are some technical possibilities for those provisions, but I would find it surprising if that had a big effect.
Okay. We have some specific questions about specific provisions, as I invited you to ask about. And this questioner would like comments from our panelists on the process to establish the Center for Innovation that's been mentioned. At what point will stakeholder input be sought? How big of a potential for change is involved in this center?
I think there's a great deal of potential for change. The Center for Innovation is part of, right now, at least as I understand it, and there may be some changes that have made since I explored this, but the Center for Innovation is part of the Center for Strategic Planning. And along with that is embedded the Office of Research and Demonstrations, or called ORDI, which is part of the Center for Strategic Planning. Center for Innovation is in there, as well as a policy analysis shop that was established by Dr. McClellan when he was at CMS. How that gets reorganized, I'm not really sure of, but I know that Tony Rogers, who has come on board at CMS as the head of the Center for Strategic Planning, is already meeting with a lot of the stakeholder groups to talk about how he envisions adopting innovations. And that, as I understand it at least, and I have not heard him speak personally, is developing areas where people or institutions are actually doing some innovative things, with the idea that these are kind of learning labs that could then be applied as we learn from those kinds of entities to more and other types of organizations that could gradually adopt and innovate along with the kind of core learning labs that he's established. And I think that's a more promising approach than what we've seen in the past, because I think that a lot of what's happening in the private sector is far ahead of where the Medicare and Medicaid programs are, frankly. And I think there's a lot to be learned from that kind of adaptation. And so I'm very hopeful that there will be a lot of change. We have many members who are very interested in it, and not to mention that it comes along with $10 billion worth of funding, which is a little bit different than this concept of demonstration projects, where it often has to be budget neutral and there's no money attached. So I think that this is quite a different kind of entity that they've developed.
It's going to have to basically depart completely from how CMS and HCFA have viewed the whole R&D portion of their charge. And I say that because there has been a very structured process, usually with a requirement of having it be budget neutral at least over a 3 or 5 year period, if not an annual basis, an evaluation attached to the demonstration. The problem has been that they have tended too often to be too risk-averse, not being willing to be as on the edge as some of the private sector changes. And even so, when they have had failures, as some of them have, it's been very difficult to make changes in the interim to try to correct based on the learning. Now, there's going to be a very big challenge. We had this discussion at one of your previous sessions. And that is, there's going to be this trade-off between how do you know when something works if you allow enough flexibility that you don't really have good controls for your experimental design and you allow mid-course corrections, which you're going to want to do. The people who are going to be affected, institutions or clinicians or patients, are going to want to or are likely to push back if they don't like some of the outcomes. And so figuring out how in this much more flexible, rapidly changing world you are able to demonstrate that you have good outcomes in lower cost or improved quality or hopefully both when you don't have a very tight experimental design is going to require a lot of challenge and a lot of fleet of foot. And while my understanding, not a lawyer and haven't really tried to read the language myself on this, is that while there is said to be an ability by the Secretary to enlarge the applicability of successful pilots, I have already heard mutterings that there is sufficient uncertainty about this that it is likely to land in court when the attempt is used to enlarge up to basically a national payment change that has not been officially approved or legislated by the Congress that results from one of these demonstrations. My concern all along has been that if there wasn't legislation that triggered successful pilots into operations, we would repeat the history that we have seen for the last couple of decades, which is extreme difficulty in getting successful demonstrations actually into the law. And it's because by the time you know that they've worked, some other group is around, which may not have the same attachment to this, or just because you can't get a legislative change on that issue from the Congress because their head is elsewhere. So I'm very worried that if we see the kind of innovation that I think all of us hope will occur, that it is flexible, that it is able to crack some of the problems about bundled payments and accountable care organizations, other innovations in terms of delivery, will it actually impact how care is delivered in Medicare? It probably, I have a little bit of a jaundiced view because of my heart bypass demonstration experience from the early 1990s, and other, just how difficult it was to get Arizona's R&D, I think it was a 13 or 14-year R&D program, waiver program, that kept going because they couldn't get the legislation to allow Arizona to actually implement into law. Their very successful demonstration, no one wanted to kill it, but they couldn't get the legislation until the rules of Medicaid were changed for other reasons. So historically, this has been a big challenge, and I'm sure it will be. But it's not a regulatory challenge per se.
Catherine?
Oh, the only comment that I would make is that, you know, on its face, the language does appear. Well, first of all, there are two things that I think are just unprecedented. I've never seen Congress give this sort of authority to the Secretary before. One is to allow literally a waiver of virtually any provision of Medicare or Medicaid law. And the second would give the authority for certain projects. There are some projects that the Secretary is given the authority to move forward without going back to additional to get additional authority from Congress. But there are others that the language does appear to give the Secretary the authority to move forward with a certain payment, a nationwide payment mechanism. And that was certainly just based on discussions that I had with some of the members of Congress who sponsored that. I think the Senator Warner spearheaded getting that language in the Senate bill and the group of five freshmen. And I know they made it very clear that that was their intent when they were pushing.
That's why we have courts.
Yeah. Is now when we start talking about Chevron?
Well, let me just ask one further question in that line. The original question had to do with a timeline of regulatory action on this topic. How much of what we've just been talking about is going to be covered in regulations, and how much of it is already embedded in the statute that's not going to have to be published in regulation so that you won't have a chance to comment on it?
Well, that's very interesting, and it's why I think, and I'm sure for a lot of reasons, that when there's an attempt to go national with some of the pilots that they will be challenged in the courts as to whether or not this actually was provided in the statutory language. But that is exactly the kind of questions that will rise. Surely you are not going to do a rulemaking for the pilots. I mean, that would mean 18 months before any pilots got going, in addition to whatever else is going on. So you will have pilots that have not been subject to rulemaking at whatever point they effectively become the payment of Medicare. I can't imagine that they won't be challenged for not having gone through a rulemaking process.
We have just a few more minutes, and another fairly specific question. The person wants to know what the rulemaking or policy process is going to be, if there is one envisioned, for defining the essential benefits package. What is it that you're requiring people to have? What is it that you're requiring employers to cover? What is it that you're going to make sure Medicaid covers or is in the exchanges? All of that comes from the benefit package. Is this pretty much in the Secretary's discretion? Is that the general response?
Yeah, I think so. I think anything that we could say at this point would just be speculation. We haven't been given any indication from the agency as to how they're going to proceed. Well,
although the services required as part of the essential benefit package are pretty much prescribed in the legislation. It's just
a matter of interpretation.
Yeah.
Again, it's one thing to say hospital, dental, physician.
Right.
I mean, you know, that's part of that's sort of the same as the medically appropriate for me in terms of and who defines that. So it is true that the names are there, but I'm not sure how complete it is in terms of actually being able to describe what kind of a benefit falls within that. We certainly have seen within Medicaid, for example, where there has been far more discretion granted, that states historically have covered a named service, but with severe restrictions as to what is included. Now, there are, in some cases, limits on copayments, or there are some provisions or preventive services without copayments, for example. But naming the area of the service is frequently not sufficient to get you out of this problem of what exactly does that mean.
Well, because it's all based on actuarial value, right?
All based on actuarial value. We've got one last question. Give you a chance to be expansive and maybe go beyond regulation. While the goals of this law are truly commendable and far-reaching, it seems as if the very expansiveness will make it difficult to achieve the lofty goals. Can federal agencies really pull this off? A congressional staffer wants to know.
Pull what off?
Well, I think that is a very appropriate
response. I mean, I say that
response.
They can make certain technical changes occur in terms of broadening the Medicaid eligibility, putting out various insurance packages in terms of or oversight of those insurance packages at the from the state exchanges. The challenge about whether or not this legislation produces more than coverage expansion, which it will do if allowed to unfold as it is legislated, that's the part that is hard to know. There are many ifs that have to occur in order to see anything remotely like reform of the delivery system or the slowing of spending. Learning from the Center for Innovation, some success in terms of some of the pilots that are implemented, an ability to effectively expand to a national level, or some kind of piecing together of innovations that have a big impact. Being able to have all of these adopted in a way that produces a slowing of expenditures and figuring out how you do this at the same time you're basically running the programs that you mentioned correctly are ongoing. I mean, these are, I don't know, $700-800 billion programs now that are running along. Medicare and Medicaid have to continue at the federal level, and it was really federal that I was focusing on, until there is something in its place, figuring out how Medicaid and SHIP live side by side and whether what is now in the legislation, you know, makes sense over time. So that's really, you know, if you mean will the government be able to expand coverage in the way that the legislation suggests, sure, maybe not exactly on time, but, you know, that part, it can happen. It's the other parts that are way less clear, to my mind, at this point, because there are so many things that have to happen. And then if you figure out what works, you've got to actually make it happen.
Catherine?
Yeah, I think being a glass-half-full kind of person, I have to say yes. But I think it's going to take tremendous collaboration between the administration and states and localities and businesses and provider groups and consumer groups. And those that want to come to the table and bring their ideas, I think they should have the opportunity to do that, and I think the administration can and will work with them to make it work for all stakeholders. But again, you know, there's sort of a challenge to both sides to sit down and work through these very difficult issues, and there will be a lot of back and forth, and there will have to be considerable compromises in order to make this work. But I do tend to be somewhat optimistic here.
Linda?
I tend to agree with Gail in terms of how hard this is going to be to do. I'm hopeful, but, you know, one of the things I take away from my experience on the Hill and working from CMS is you have patients and taxpayers
as constituents
that you certainly need to please when you're on the Hill and you're at CMS. It's not necessarily the providers, however they deliver the services. I just think the way we have care delivery organized today really needs to be turned on its head. For example, paying, you know, there are things that should be done that Medicare won't pay for, yet could improve care and reduce costs. And I think we have to think about how to go forward in that area, and that's really outside the box of what exists now. And I think that's going to be the big challenge, making sure that that can be done as well as better patient care and guarding, you know, taxpayers' investment in these programs. So we'll see.
Indeed, we will. Thank you very much. Let me remind you there are some handouts outside that you pick up on your way out, and that we'd love you to fill out that full evaluation form before you leave. I want to thank the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Brian and David Colby and his friends in Princeton, for supporting and helping us get started on this, and remind you that we'll continue this conversation on August 2nd with a much stronger emphasis on the federal-state relations. I want to thank the staff of the Alliance for Health Reform. There's a neat little listing with brief bios and pictures of them. You'll know who really makes this stuff work if you look at those sheets. And finally, I ask you to help me thank our panel for an incredibly useful discussion. This stuff is not easy. Thank you all.
Thank you.
That was great.
That was good. Good. I'm glad. Those were